Stealing a library book may sound kind of petty, but it was big money for the subjects of today's focus. Nearly a century ago, the business of rare books was booming, and rare books owned by public libraries were tempting targets for thieves. Travis McDade curates the rare book collection at the University of Illinois College of Law, and he's written about a ring of book thieves active on the East Coast in the 1930s, the effort to capture them, and the allure of the book in an age before Kindle. I'm Jim Meadows. We'll talk about the thieves of Book Row and whether there's any money in stealing books nowadays, today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. We're not taking calls this hour, but we'll be back live tomorrow at 10 a.m. on WYLL AM 580. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and Travis McDade should be a familiar voice to some of you because he's part of our team of commentators on legal issues in the news, which you can hear usually Monday mornings on Morning Edition, and also on demand at our website at will.illinois.edu. Travis is in charge of the rare book collection at the University of Illinois Law Library, and perhaps it's the value of the collection that's gotten him interested in book theft, because he's written about book theft before with his previous book, The Book Thief, The True Crimes of Daniel Spiegelman. He teaches a class at the U of I called Rare Books, Crime and Punishment, which I gather covers not just book thievery, but also other illegal things you can do to books.
Absolutely.
And your latest book from Oxford University Press is Thieves of Book Row, New York's Most Notorious Rare Book Ring, and the Man Who Stopped It. Professor McDade, welcome to Focus.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You know, when I read this book, I thought, how did you find out all this stuff? Because it just sounded like the sort of thing that people would not be keeping track of in this sort of detail. You have things about the personalities of really disreputable people that most other people would not care enough about to write down. How did you put all this story together?
Yeah, that was a big problem. I started basically with a few newspaper articles, and the newspaper articles, even if they cover the seamy side of life, they don't cover it in depth, and they don't get into the psychology of it or the motivation of the people. So I knew about the crime just from some local New York newspapers. And the first sort of personal side of the story I got was by a man named Caius Metcalf, who was a longtime librarian at Harvard, and that's how I knew him. But before that, he was a librarian at a reference librarian at the New York Public Library.
And we should note the New York Public Library plays a big part
in this story. Absolutely. And it's a fantastic institution for a number of reasons, but not least of which is the reason that it plays an important part in my story. That's that it had a great collection that was well protected. But Caius Metcalf left NYPL in, I think, 1937 to go to Harvard. But the action in this book takes place in the late 20s and early 30s, and so he was still there. And as it happened, I discovered his memoirs on a shelf in downtown Champaign on the old main bookshop down there one Saturday morning several years ago. And he wrote his side of what I had only known from these newspaper accounts. And so once I read that, I thought, oh, well, maybe there's an article here, a pretty good-sized article. Eventually, after I was doing research from here in Champaign, basically through newspapers, periodicals, that sort of thing, and some book research, because there would be snippets here and there, I decided, well, I have to go to New York to see what's there. And that's where I found, I found some good court records, and court records are pretty good at, especially when you have testimony and depositions, that sort of thing, pretty good at telling the personal side of these things. Like they tell you how people felt about them, what action people actually took, it just sort of built that way.
And you really had to, travel around, because this story goes out to Boston.
Yeah,
it goes
sure.
out to a lot of small town libraries
sure.
that got burned this way. It goes out to a lot of bookstores. It
yep.
goes back into Canada at one point.
Yep.
So there's just a lot of territory being covered by this whole story.
Yep.
And if you have questions for Travis McDade, or if you have a tale about a rare book lost or found, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And this story, it's partially about a story about the selling and the buying and the stealing of books. And it's also a story about something about the mystique of the books themselves, and the appeal that collecting rare books had at this period in time. We're talking the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, that's right. There was a one of the things I mentioned in the book is that people had been stealing from American libraries, you know, since the day after the first American library was founded. Essentially, you know, it's slightly less old than libraries themselves. Library theft is. But starting in the early 20th century, there was a sort of a resurgence, I guess, or a focus on what's called Americana, and that's basically, it's the loose definition, but it's basically anything dealing with the foundation of the country, the 19th century expansion of the country, anything about the United States, or as one book collector says it, anything about the story being that of the foundation and the westward expansion of the United States, and so anything written about, printed in, or written in manuscript form in the 19th century, and at some point later in the early 20th century, that was about the United States, had a certain sort of value. Now, certain things had more value than others, of course. Edgar Allan Poe books were valuable, and the famous 19th century authors that we think of, Melville and Hawthorne and Emerson and Thoreau, of course, had a great deal of value. But as prices rose for these things in the first couple of decades of the 20th century and on through the 1920s, they sort of brought with them, you know, they had a long tail, and they sort of brought with them all of these other things that we would consider of marginal value and of marginal interest. They suddenly had more cachet and were suddenly worth a great deal of value. So sort of a rising tide raised the estimation of all these things, and so you had things that weren't necessarily even particularly rare and wouldn't ordinarily be valuable. Once you had this sort of Americana bubble in the 1920s, people were just doing anything they could to get their hands on the stuff.
And it's interesting, throughout this book, through all the stolen merchandise you're looking at, it's all Americana. We're not looking at first editions of Dickens or Jane Austen or early editions of the Bible.
Right.
It's American authors and American history. And you follow one particular book all the way through your story. And that is one which, by the way, you can pick up for $11.69 in paperback on Amazon. Al-Araf, Tamerlane and Minor Poems by Edgar Allan Poe. It's like his second published book.
Yeah, his first book was called Tamerlane, but it was it didn't have his name on it. It was just attributed to a Bostonian. So in 1829, he publishes Al-Araf, Tamerlane, and Minor Poems, which is the first book to have Edgar Allan Poe's name on it. Published in Baltimore by Hatch and Dunning, and was just sort of a plain-looking. One of the funny things about this, and I have a few pages on this in the book, is that this is true of a lot of books, but Poe, maybe more than anyone else, is that his early publications were so ordinary looking, I say they were ugly, and the only thing that made them pretty was you know the rarity of them and that they were by him, but people just either discarded them or they kept them at the bottom of a pile or they kept them in the attic. They didn't think anything of them, and even when relatively knowledgeable people would come across them, they also wouldn't think anything of it. This Al-Araf was very valuable at the time. there were several Poe items in the 1920s and 1930s that were extremely valuable, among the most valuable things in America. He was among the most valuable, most collectible of American authors at the time, most popular with collectors. And this was considered by one man, Charles Hartman, who was in a position to know. He was a dealer, and he was the editor of a book called American Book Collector at the time. This book was the most rare, the least likely to be on the market. And so this copy of Olerof, Tamerlane and Minor Poems was in the New York Public Library. And one of these guys who was one of the ringleaders of this book theft ring decided that he should have it in his collection instead of it being in the New York Public Library.
This raises the question, why would a public library, which has books available to the public, want to have a rare book in their collection instead of a more recent, cheaper edition that they could loan out without feeling afraid about it?
Oh, that's an interesting philosophical question.
Why did so many libraries have these rare books, apparently? Because you write about these book thieves going especially to the relatively unguarded small-town libraries throughout New England and the East Coast, just ripping off books that were valuable and very available.
Well, when it comes to a place like the New York Public Library, the collection there was I don't want to say one of a kind, but it was close to it. I mean, it was just an astounding collection, particularly for a library that had been founded only in the late 19th century, but the building opened in 1911. And the antecedent libraries to the New York Public Library are the Lenox Library, which was a fantastic 19th century collection, and the Astor Library. Why did they have this fantastic collection? Well, partly because they got most of this stuff from the Lenox Library. In fact, Olerof, Tamerlane and Minor Poems had been in the Lenox Library, and so they just sort of inherited these books. And then they decided it's not like they acquired these through purchase. They inherited these books, mm-hmm. and they decided that they should have this, what they called the reserve book room, what other places called the treasure room, where they would sequester these things so that folks couldn't get at them. The New York Public Library was also interesting in that it didn't have a lending library at all. All of the books that you wanted to read that were in the New York Public Library's collection, you would have to go to and read in this
magnificent. At that time, you could not check out
books.
That's right.
And so this idea that you would have these books that didn't circulate outside the building was not exactly strange. They had a lot of great books that were kept for the benefit of the public for the sake of research. And that's what, today, of course, that's why we have rare book libraries. But even then, the New York Public Library was ahead of the game.
Now, the small town libraries that were also victims to these book thieves, would they be lending libraries or would they be keep them in the building libraries?
No, generally they would be lending libraries.
And how did they get those rare books? Is it just maybe because some wealthy benefactor died and those are the books he left or something like that?
Yeah, not even that really as much as many of the things that were of value in the 19-teens and 1920s had been bought just in the normal course of buying a book, a book as it comes out in the 1800s. So in the 1860s and 1870s, they would have bought these first edition.
Olerof, Tamerlane and Minor Poems was not valuable at the time.
Yes, but they probably wouldn't have bought that. They would have bought Melville and Thoreau and Emily Dickinson and these sorts of things that they then would have sort of parked on their shelf for 50 years and not thought too much about that. One of the interesting things about this is there's this confluence of events. It's not just the rise in the value of Americana, but it's the rise in the ability of people to get around. The ability of people to travel to Western Massachusetts or upstate New York in the 19th century was fairly limited, right? I mean, people just wouldn't do it on a whim. It would be a journey that you would undertake with some deliberation. But by the 1920s and 1930s, that had changed a lot. You could get around fairly easily. And so these libraries suddenly became more accessible, and libraries that had never really been targeted in a big way. They'd been targeted in a minor way, as I mentioned in my book a little bit in the history part of it, but all of a sudden became more accessible, and there was it made more sense for people to travel a longer distance to get there because travel was easier, and the rise and the value of these things made it worth it. So some of these librarians just didn't think that people would travel to steal a book that's worth $50 or even $10. But it became, you know, with economies of scale, it became worth it for people to do that.
Well, we are talking with Travis McDade about stealing books and some people who did with some success about, say, 80 years ago. He's written about it in his book, Thieves of Book Row. It's published by Oxford University Press. If you have any questions or comments, email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to bring in a different setting here. We've been talking about libraries from which these books were stolen. Let's talk about the places where these books often ended up, and that is used bookstores. You know, my sister is a big book lover, and every now and then she and her husband go to New York City, and they like to hang around the Strand
Sure.
bookstore, which is a gigantic secondhand
Yeah.
bookstore,
Yep.
which I understand is located in an area that used to be called Book Row, because it wasn't just the Strand that was there, it was a lot of secondhand bookstores.
Sure. So Book Row was on 4th Avenue in Lower Manhattan. For people who know the area, it's sort of on the east side of town, on the lower east side, from Union Square to Astor Place, for Astor Place to Union Square if you're going south to north. And the Strand bookstore is one of these. There's only a couple bookstores left of the heyday of Book Row. Which started to decline in a big way in the 1950s and 60s as rents went up. But the Strand is one of these sort of remnants of the past, and it's a gorgeous bookstore there. It's actually a street over. It's sort of at the north end of what would have been Book Row. I think it's on 12th, and then it's on Broadway, so a street over from 4th Avenue. You know, another of the bookstores that's still that got its start in Book Row, but then moved north, is called the Argosy Bookstore, a famous New York institution. Now it's in Midtown, but it got its start by a man named Lou Cohen. Started it in 1925 down there on Book Row, and then eventually in the 1930s moved up to I think it's 57th Street, but I'm not entirely certain. It's in that area.
Well, the relevance of these bookstores, of Book Row, is that it sounds like a lot of the operators of these bookstores were either directly or indirectly involved in selling stolen books.
Yeah.
And, of course, as your book explains, there was a certain amount of book thievery going on all the time.
Sure.
But you write about actually a ring of book thieves, and I want to bring in three names: Charles Romm, Ben Harris, and Harry Gold. Was there anybody else in that ring?
There were other people who may have played a prominent role. These are the only guys who eventually get their just desserts.
And they were booksellers. They owned bookstores,
Yep.
respectable as far as people knew.
In the case of Charles Romm, he was a longtime Americana dealer and seemed to people to be perfectly legit. The other two were newer to the game, and Harry Gold, I talk about in particular, was very zealous in the book theft game. But yeah, to all outside viewers, these were just guys who owned shops, and you could go in and buy books from their from their shelves and not think anything of it.
And the prices would vary. There would be very inexpensive stuff.
Yeah.
There would be stuff that would be reasonably priced, and then there'd be the really fancy stuff. What sort of prices are we talking for a rare and valuable book on average, if there is such a thing?
Well, yeah, it would really vary depending on the book and depending on the time. One of the things I note is that the value of Al-Araf itself waxed and waned because the time period we're talking about, the late 1920s and early 1930s, we of course get the Great Depression starting in late 1929, and so in 1929 a lot of these books were I mentioned the term bubble. They were absolutely susceptible to this bubble, and they were a lot higher priced than they probably should have been.
Just like a lot of things in the 1920s that people thought
exactly.
were just going to keep on going up.
That's right. That was the idea, that the stock market was going to keep on going up, and so the price of these things was going to keep on going up. And you could spend a mint on something that even 10 years earlier you had spent a pittance on, and then expect to double that mint within a few years. Because that's what had been happening, and you know the sort of optimism of the investor or the speculative buyer drove a lot of this stuff, and it wasn't just internal to them. I mean, people were newspapers were advertising this stuff, magazines were covering this stuff, and so people thought that these things were great investments.
It's like every few years you read now about someone selling their rare comic book. There were no comic books at that time, but there was rare Americana that would get talked about in the same way, and especially the most expensive thing would get the most coverage that would get people going on.
Sure, yeah, and people were talking about it the same way. That you know, you're right. That's a good comparison. So when people see Action Comics with Superman in it selling for a fortune, people are like, oh, it's just a comic book. I can't believe that. Maybe I shouldn't be collecting these. That's the same thing that happened with Americana. You started to get people who weren't interested, who weren't collectors, who weren't just regular folks who were interested in books, but people who had money and who wanted to invest in something they thought would make them, if not a quick buck, then a solid investment that would mature, in the high percentages over a few years. And, of course, that all came a cropper in 1929 or 1931.
And did that sort of make the booksellers a little more interested, maybe even desperate, to go for stealing stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. In the 1920s, getting books for very cheap or for free from the people who had stolen them was a good business practice, and if your competitors were doing the same thing, you kind of had to do it to keep up, to stay in business. In the 1930s, on the other hand, when people stopped paying these large sums of money for these mediocre books, it became a necessity to get these books for cheap or for free. It went from the sort of voluntary looting to almost necessary looting of libraries in the 1930s.
In the 20s, was there big money to be made in trafficking stolen books? Did people who do this, did they become really wealthy, or was it
no.
sort of, were they sort of chasing a chimera here?
Yeah, well, of course, the people who actually did, the low-level guy who actually did the, who risked it and actually did the stealing, made very little. They made
but Charles Rum, Ben Harris, and Harry Gold.
Those guys made some money. Yeah, yeah. Those guys did all right. Harry Gold, for his part, I earlier mentioned that he got his comeuppance, and eventually goes to prison. And then he gets out of prison, and he's still got a ton of money, and he starts another bookstore, and then he eventually, he leads a very successful life after this. He didn't suffer any financial penalty, and he didn't have to give any of the money back that he made. It's sort of the classic story. The low level people didn't really make much money, and they bore a lot of the risk. And then
how did they do it?
The guys who are actually stealing.
Yeah, how do you successfully steal a book that isn't supposed to leave the building?
Well, it depends largely on the library, but for a lot of these, what I call these hinterland libraries in the backwaters of Western Massachusetts and New York and Connecticut, they weren't overly protected, so it wasn't like there was a big security apparatus to defeat. Basically, you needed a big, large coat with some interior pockets, and you needed to have a distracted librarian. Or you needed to be very charming, and you could walk out with three or four books and secreted in pockets. And the other neat thing for book thieves at the time was that men wore overcoats all the time, right? I mean, now men wearing an overcoat, especially in nice weather, is maybe a little suspicious. But at the time, men wore overcoats all the time, having a garment that just had these few pockets sewn into it that you would ordinarily wear was just as natural as anything. And so these guys would just walk in there, take some books out, and be done.
And if you're talking about a tougher place, and I take it this copy of Al-Haraf, Tamerlane, and Minor Poems came from the New York Public Library and the book reserve room, mm-hmm. and were there guards there?
Not guards as much, but even more fearsome. They had attentive librarians.
More fearsome
than guards. Yes, that's right. There were guards at the entrance to the New York Public Library, the exit, rather, to the New York Public Library, former New York City police officers, which was itself a new thing. I mean, this was really an astounding.
After having realized that there were thefts going on, they started to actually put some security out there.
Yes, they did. But they actually started when the New York Public Library was founded. They had already thought. I mentioned the antecedent libraries had already thought about security, and the Astor Library in particular had thought about it. And so they had former New York City police officers manning the exit doors and checking bags right from the very beginning of the New York Public Library. But I mentioned the librarians at the Reserve Book Room. What they had basically was this room full of all their treasures and they had two librarians on staff in this tiny little room, and that's about as good as you can do. That's the greatest security you can have, is two librarians who are paying attention.
But
one Saturday in January of 1931, they would always have two librarians in the reserve book room. And the only time that didn't work was on Saturday, because they weren't fully staffed on Saturdays. And so they only had one librarian working one half-hour shift while the other librarian went to get lunch. That was the one weakness. And on this one particular Saturday, Samuel Dupree, who was commissioned to commit this crime, he'd spent a lot of time at this library, getting to know it, getting to know the librarians, getting to know the collection, getting to know the egress, getting to know everything about the place, so that he could successfully steal from this reserve book room. Which, let me say, was on the third floor, about as far away from an exit as you could get. I mean, this place was basically locked down. It was about as good security as you could get. In any event, working on this Saturday was John Elliott, a very old librarian who had been from the Astor Library. So he had been around many years, and he had come to know Samuel Dupree, who of course had given him a false name, and on this Saturday, Dupree eventually distracts him by asking for these other three books, and so John Elliott has to leave the reserve book room, which he's loath to do, but because he trusts this guy from knowing him a little bit, he says, I'll go get these books and I'll be back in a second, but don't move. And of course
he moves.
He has these books that he'd already ordered. They're sitting there in front of him, and with the help of a couple of Confederates that I mentioned,
they essentially run out of the New York Public Library.
That's right. Yeah, they run the, and it's a very long run, but they make it.
It's starting to sound like the Public Library edition of Ocean's 11 here.
Except not even that suave, right? I mean, it's sort of a smash and grab. It's after they do the smart sort of getting to know the place, they just make a run for it.
Well, how do these books get on the market? First of all, they're library books. They're marked in various ways. I don't think they had little. They had little card pockets back in them, if you're talking about the rare book room, but they were marked in some ways.
Sure, they were all stamped, New York Public Library. That's one of the important parts about the rare book theft ring, is that it had this separate ability. It was a cottage industry of getting rid of bookmarks, whether they're ink stamp, whether they're the embossed stamp, or whether they're the perforation.
It's like the reverse of counterfeiting money. You're taking markings away here.
Absolutely. Well, and counterfeiting sometimes comes in handy or forgery comes in handy, because if a page is sort of intractable, that's the right word, but when it comes to
if you can't clean up the markings,
if you can't clean up, that's
page.
Right, then you cut it out and you make a duplicate page and insert it somehow.
This is called, I understood, sophisticating a book.
Sophisticating a book is a robust and a trade with a long lineage that didn't necessarily have anything to do with book theft, but came in handy when it came to book thievery for this very reason. But sophisticating was generally taking a couple of lesser books and combining them to make a better book. So if you had a a bad edition of a first, if you had a bad copy of a first edition and a good copy of a second edition, you might combine them in certain ways so that they would make a false good copy of a first edition.
You might even take off the book's cover to make it harder to trace.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. That happened to Olaroff. So the cover had a lot of information on it that suggested it belonged to the New York Public Library, and they removed the cover.
Well, we're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be back to talk more about the progress of the book thieves of Book Row and how much that copy of Olaroff went for. After this short break, this is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're back with Focus. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows here with Travis McDade, and we're going through his book, Looking Up Prices, trying to figure out what the value of things were in the world of 1920s and 30s book thievery, not just book thievery, but book collecting. Travis's book is The Thieves of Book Row, New York's Most Notorious Rare Book Ring and the Man Who Stopped It, published by Oxford University Press. One thing you spent a lot of time on is really just an example of just how big the market was, is this really lavish, I guess, book auction that was held in the 1920s by the songwriter Jerome Kern. He had a big collection, too big for him to enjoy, so he just decided to sell it.
He did decide to sell it, and he was one of these guys who'd made a bunch of money in musical theater, and he had purchased, starting in the late 19-teens and right up to 1929, some great books. But no one thought that this collection was that great. It had some highlights, but it was mostly just it was fairly mundane, or would have been fairly mundane if it wasn't 1929. And it was sort of the high water mark in terms of the prices people would pay for these things. And everyone, the auctioneers, Kern, everyone around it had their expectations blown by the prices that people were willing to pay for these things right from the beginning.
There was an example of a book by Elizabeth Barrett Browning that Jerome Kern had paid maybe $1,600 for earlier in the decade, auctioning off for $17,000.
Yeah, there was a lot of that where I put a number of prices in there of books that had been bought by him for even a tenth of what they went for in 1929, as recently as 5 years earlier. It was fun for me to do that. It was fun for me to go back and look at the prices he'd paid for them, and then the prices that people were willing to pay for them in the Kern auction, and it was astounding. I tried to give some sense of how this represented the market at the time, and how people were willing, not necessarily because of what they thought was rising value, but also because of ego. I mean, there were a lot of these book dealers in there. I mentioned A.S.W. Rosenbach, who comes up again and again in the book, and who's sort of the most important American book dealer, maybe of all time, but certainly of that era, who had a bunch of rivals, and these rivals didn't want to let him get away with with paying cheap prices, in many ways in many instances to buy back books that he had sold to Kern himself. And so people were running up these prices in a very legitimate way. There wasn't any shenanigans going on. It wasn't collusion or anything. These people were wanting to get these books and wanting to let other people get them cheaply. And so, the bidding just got out of hand. I mean, it was just nuts.
Well, Olaroff, Tamerlane, and Minor Poems, a first edition, of which there seem to be maybe 18 copies left that we know of.
Yeah, that's right.
Would you estimate in the book maybe command $500,000 in today's money?
I think that's probably right. It hasn't been on the market for a long while, but I think that's probably what it would get.
This hot copy of Olaroff from the New York Public Library, once it was stolen, did the booksellers get a chance to sell it?
Yeah, they tried to. So I tried to estimate what the value of a market copy of Olaroff would have been at the time of in 1931, and it was sort of difficult to do. In 1928, A.S.W. Rosenbach had sold a copy for $30,000, but That was, of course, in the 20s, and that was a different copy. It was a copy associated with Poe. But he had also, or another dealer offered in the 1930s, $5,000 for a copy of Olerof, a decent copy of Olerof. So my estimate is that it would, in 1931, it could be legitimately sold for $5,000. But that's a legitimate copy. A stolen copy,
For less.
You have to discount it. That's right. And so the guy who had it was trying to sell it for $2,000, and people seemed to be willing to pay about $1,000 for it.
$1,000, which would have been considered a real bargain for Al-Haram.
Right. Though in 1931, $1,000 would have been a lot of money.
But would people have had suspicions?
Yeah, that's another thing I sort of talk about is, and it's sort of troubling to me that more people didn't do the right thing, or at least suspect that this thing was stolen, and you know, be more circumspect about it.
Not just people in the bookstore trade, but customers.
Customers too. Yeah, you're right. I do mention a few customers, and I mentioned that Lily, the famous benefactor of Indiana University, the Lilly Library there. Who was, of course, the scion of the Eli Lilly
pharmaceutical company?
That's right. And so he had a bunch of money and was buying a bunch of books. And he was on the up and up when it came to this, because he had, in fact, I think Gabriel Wells offered him an Olerof at some point in the 30s, and Lilly wrote back to say something to the effect of, "I heard a copy of this was stolen. This isn't that stolen copy. If it is, why don't want it?" You know. So he was reputable. Not everyone was, of course, and they would do whatever to get their hands on it. But as far as the dealers go, with the sort of train of custody of Olerof, once it leaves the New York Public Library, it goes from Samuel Dupree's hands to Harry Gold's hands. Harry Gold turns around and sells it to a man, or gives it on consignment to a man named Abe Schifrin, who was a longtime Book Row dealer. Schifrin takes it to a man named Harry Stone, and Harry Stone was a longtime dealer. Who was in Midtown and was used to dealing in American first editions and was sort of a higher end bookseller than of course Gold or Schifrin, and so it was sort of being passed up the food chain, and then Stone in turn takes it to Arthur Swan. Now any of those three guys, Schifrin, Stone, and Swan, ought to have known or ought to have suspected that there was something going on here.
But they looked the other way.
They looked the other way, and particularly Arthur Swan, who knew this thing was stolen, did.
Well, let's move a little bit away from this cesspool of moral ambiguity now into the hero of the book, and that's the library inspector. And he's not a police officer. He's a library inspector hired by the New York Public Library to try to stop these book thefts. He's G. William Berquist.
That's right.
How do you get a job like that?
He's an American original, though he wasn't the first special detective. So the New York Public Library in 1911, and shortly after the opening of the library, realized that it should dedicate a man to do the work of keeping the collection safe, but not only just keeping the collection safe, but also keeping people from having fights and chewing tobacco and smoking and doing all these other you know minor crimes in the New York Public Library. And that man's name was Edwin White Galliard, who had been a librarian in New York for many years, and just sort of had an aptitude for this job. He was the detective there, the book detective there at the New York Public Library, and an enrolled member of the local police precinct too. He learned with the police how to help prosecute crimes, stake out a crime scene. I do all these other things, but he died in 1928. And Berquist at the time was a very interesting and genial fellow who was a World War I vet and had lived quite a interesting life, but was bookish and knowledgeable and pleasant. And so he had gone to school at the New York Public Library's library school and had worked in the stacks while he was going to school there. And in 1929 was in California working he was a director of a library on a Navy base there, and Caius Metcalf sends him a note saying, you know, I wonder if you'd consider coming back here to be our detective, and he said sure, and so he came back to New York and And so Bergquist becomes this guy whose job it is to keep books safe. And one of the interesting things about that is there had never been a worse time for books than when Bergquist starts. I mean, he gets thrown into the fire here. And
there were really books, a lot of books walking out of libraries that were worth money.
There were books walking out of libraries worth a lot of money. And one of his charge was not just to keep the New York Public Library safe. I mean, that's specifically what he was there to do. But he also tried to help other librarians who didn't have these detectives working for them to track down criminals from other libraries, particularly in the New York area, but also, you know, all over. If he could help people out, he was willing to do it.
If you have a question or comment for Travis McDade about rare books and this book ring that operated among rare book dealers in New York in the 1920s and 30s, you can email us at wyll-talk@illinois.edu. Travis's book is Thieves of Book Row, New York's Most Notorious Rare Book Ring, and the Man Who Stopped It. You know, I was struck as I was reading the book and going through the whole process of apprehending the book thieves, and it did involve at one point like the investigators detaining booksellers to question them. There was never a shootout. This is not quite like bootleggers
right.
in 1920s. There were some threats later on by some of the thieves who testified for the prosecutors. But you never actually saw a big fist fight or guns fired or things like that.
No, that's right. You know, this is a big organized crime time. We think of the 20s and 30s, you know, Al Capone and all that sort of thing. I didn't find any evidence that there was a big organized crime component to this, though I'd be surprised if there wasn't some component to it. But no shootouts. That would have been interesting. You know, it's a quiet book thievery is a quiet profession, and so
even people who are fearing that they may be being going to prison, and some of them did for a few years anyway.
Sure,
managed to keep relatively nonviolent about it. I wanted to bring up just two names of two people with the same job, but who were just struck by how different they were.
Yeah.
And these were two of the people who had to be on the ground in the library stealing the books. William Babyface Mahoney. Babyface,
yeah.
They
yeah.
really called him that.
Yeah.
And Harold Borden Clark. William Babyface Mahoney interested me because he is someone who actually goes to the other side and becomes a library investigator himself.
Yeah, that's right. He works at the Newark Public Library. So one of the things about Bergquist was that his main intent when there was a library theft was A, to get the books back, and B, to turn the bad guy into a good guy. And he had this sort of, I guess, wellspring of good feelings in his heart, this optimism that human nature could be turned back to the right side.
It rarely worked, I gather.
It almost never worked. That's right.
But in this case,
it did. It worked in spades. He got this guy who was you know, very feared amongst libraries, particularly in Massachusetts and the Boston area. I think Mahoney was sort of tired of the whole racket. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, to travel around to steal books, and I think he was ready to quit. And if he got a legit job and Bergquist offered him one, I think he was willing to come over and be a good guy for a while, and so it worked with him.
Harold Borden Clark, on the other hand, was, I believe you describe him in your book, as a piece of work.
He was a piece of work. An interesting guy, came down from Canada, sort of fleeing Canada on some criminal charges and wound up in Boston in the late 1920s. You know, he was sort of he was a confidence man, but he was sort of a guy who would do whatever it took to make a buck. And the interesting thing about it, when we first started talking about how I wrote the book, one of the real important and fantastic pieces of or caches of information I got was Harold Borden Clark's archive. So after all of this takes place and he spent some time in prison, he is sent back to Canada. He's sort of exiled back to Canada and becomes a Canadian book dealer, a famous book dealer.
He becomes a very respected Canadian book dealer.
Yes, maybe the most famous book dealer of his time in Canada. And as that, he always thought a great deal of himself, and as that, he left all of his papers, his bookstore papers, to an archive in, I think it's in Ottawa, and I was able to get this, and it's hundreds and hundreds of pages of his transactions as a bookseller, but also letters he wrote to people, letters he received from people, and his thoughts on what he thought was the incorrect charging convicting of him by Bergquist and these various other guys he thought were in cahoots with Bergquist of these book crimes in the 1930s. And he really sort of writes these screeds against Bergquist and against American librarians and against the Boston police, who he thinks are corrupt. And these are all there in this archive. And I think he thought that the people who would look at his papers would be sympathetic to him, that they would see things from his perspective and say, oh, this guy was a great important bookseller, and he was a guy who didn't take any guff from anyone and sort of stood his ground. And unfortunately for him, I'm the one who I'm the only one, as far as I know, who's looked at his archive, and I came to a different conclusion.
Well, the thing about Harold Borden Clark is that you note he became a very well-respected book dealer in Canada and did a lot of business in later years after the 1930s with a lot of institutions.
Sure.
selling rare books to them or buying rare books,
yeah,
including the University of Illinois.
Including the University of Illinois,
where,
sure,
you are now a curator of rare books at the College of Law.
That's right.
Are there any books in that collection, the rare book law collection, that to your knowledge may have passed through the hands of Harold Borden Clark?
Not in the law collection that I know of. And Clark did, he at least ostensibly, and I think probably for the most part, actually got out of the book theft trade. He started with a bunch of books in the 1930s that he had stolen, that's how he sort of founded his collection. And he certainly had hard-won book knowledge from the theft ring. But by the 1950s, when the University of Illinois buys a book from him, and every Yale, Harvard, Library of Congress, every major library in the United States bought books from him. He was legitimate and was not actively stealing, though who knows what was going on in the with his underlings. But that's one of the problems with libraries in general, is that every library in the world, like every bookseller in the world, is going to have stolen books at some point, just because they don't know. I mean, the books will have been bought in good faith and bought for a price that isn't suspicious, because they've been laundered enough through so many hands. So you don't know,
and you can't really go look through the books to see if they've been sophisticated.
Yeah.
You can't look for signs of erasure. Even if you can, I don't know, have you tried this?
I have.
Could you trace them back?
I have, yes. I found a book in our collection that I thought was suspicious. I didn't know. I've actually done this with books that I personally own, but I did it with one book in the law collection that I thought was suspicious. I thought it might have been bought by Brown University in Providence, which wasn't then Brown University, but whatever the antecedent university was in the 1780s. And one of the great things about doing research these days is there's so many archival sources that are digitized, and they had a copy of one of their early purchases from a London bookseller of books for their library. And I thought this is when they would have bought it, because this is when the book would have been bought. And they have online the four page letter to this London bookseller with a list of all the books that were ordered for this library, and the book that we own wasn't on it. That was an indication that it wasn't bought for that university at the time. I did some other research to try to find if the gentleman who bought it, and I have his name, and I was able to trace his collection, bought it for the library and then sort of took it home with him, and I couldn't find any evidence of that. It appears to be on the up and up, as far as I can tell. It's certainly not obvious to me that it was a book that was stolen from any university.
You must have some books that some people would find attractive in the collection here at the U of I, both in law but of course the U of I's rare book collection,
sure,
in general.
Sure.
How are those books protected?
The RBML has a very sophisticated system of protection. They have the value of the books over there The books in the law collection pale in comparison, of course. We have a couple of mechanisms at the law library to keep books safe. One of the interesting things about it is there are only, I would say, a dozen or so books in the law collection that would be worth you risking prison time to steal. Because the idea of stealing books is not the difficult part of the crime. Making money off of these books is what's difficult. And so there aren't that many books in the law collection that would be, I mean, there are a lot of books in there that are theoretically worth a lot of money, you know, worth thousands of dollars, but they're not really worth $1,000 until you can get someone to pay you for them. And, you can't really advertise them on the open market. There are a lot of hoops you have to jump through before you can make money off of one of these books. And fortunately the law collection has a great collection, but not really that many that would be
nothing stolen recently.
Not that I know of. No, not that I know of. And I try to keep pretty close guard on it. So,
final question. We're in an era now where people are wondering about the future of the book as a physical object.
Yeah.
And what form it will take for most people. Do people care about books as something to collect the same way they did in the time that Thieves of Book Row takes place?
It's different. Although I think people still care about books as commodities. They think that if you buy certain books that the value is necessarily going to go up over time, which is sometimes true, not always true. Probably different reasons. I think nostalgia in the future is going to play a heavier part in collecting. In many ways, the idea that books are going the way of the dodo is I think going to contribute to collecting. People are going to collect them because they think they're going to become more rare. They're going to collect them because that's what they know from their childhood. They're going to collect them because they think that there's going to be this increased value on them.
We were having a discussion about whether it's even possible to collect an e-book and hold it long enough so that it becomes collectible. But since they're licensed more than they're sold, that may be a question for another day.
Yeah, right.
We are out of time. I want to thank you for being on Focus today. Travis McDade, who is a regular contributor to Legal Issues in the News and WYLL, and the author of Thieves of Book Row, New York's Most Notorious Rare Book Ring, and The Man Who Stopped It, published by Oxford University Press in hardback and, I guess, an e-book edition. Thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Jim.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WYLL. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. This is Focus on WYLL AM 580.